Shidoita Gadadha Shivasati Gaur Bhakti Rindakija. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gogopina Shanda Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Kija. Rindavan Dhamma Kija. Tura Dhamma Kija. Dabudri Maya Puri Dhamma Kija. Jagannath Puri Dhamma Kija. Gangamai Jamuna Devi Kija. Bhakti Devi Kija. Tulsi Maharani Kija. Samaveta Bhakti Rindakija. Gaur Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada Namaha Krishna. Srimati Bhakti Vinata Swami Niti Namane Namaste Sarasvati Devani Gauravani Pachamani Vizesa Sangani Paskachadi Satari. Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yujapada Kamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavam Shashi Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vitam Sam Sajiva. Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Deva. Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lavita Shri Vishakam Vitam Shah. Anchakalpa Chuvista, keep us in the media, but I'll put it in on Pavanavio, Vaishnavio. So it's October 31st, 2016, in Sandton, South Africa, and we are going to be meditating on the Govardhan Leela.
That's right.
Yay! So, even though you can't come to Pretoria tonight, you're getting it here.
Yeah.
Special preview. All right. Let's just make sure I have all my... Okay. Namaste Girirajaya Shri Govardhana Namane Ashesha Klesha Nashaya Paramananda Dayane. I offer my respectful obeisances unto the King of all hills, Govardhan Hill, the source of enjoyment for the senses, land, and cows. He is a servant of Krishna and is Krishna himself. He puts an end to unlimited sufferings and bestows the supreme bliss. So we're going to do a little meditation on this verse from the Bhagavatam, 10th canto. The Acharyas say that this verse was spoken by Srimati Radharani to her friends. So I'm going to go through it bit by bit. Of all the devotees, this Govardhan Hill is the best. Of course, it's an interesting statement. So if you've read Bihad Bhagavatamrita Part 1, you'll notice that Narada Muni is trying to find out who is the best devotee. And so he keeps going to different devotees and saying, do you have Krishna's mercy? Do you have Krishna's mercy? And each devotee he goes to says, I don't have Krishna's mercy. You have to go to so-and-so. You have to go to so-and-so. But he doesn't include Govardhan in his list. So it's interesting. You know, he goes to the Pandavas, goes to Uddhava, goes to Prahlad, goes to Hanuman, finally goes to the gopis. He doesn't go to Govardhan. And, you know, we have different statements about who's the best devotee, right? So what's a Shastric statement about who's the best devotee?
Srimati Radharani.
Srimati Radharani is often called the best devotee. What about Lord Shiva, Vaishnavayata Sambhu, that Lord Shiva is often called the best devotee? Sometimes Prahlad is called the best devotee. So we have a little bit of a difficulty with this, because in English the word best means... Well, that would be me, because I'm Edith Best. That's what it would, no, not really. Actually, one of my kids told me that whenever he wrote his name in school, the other kids would tease him, oh, you think you're so great. When we did our Learn to Read program, you know, I called it Dr. Best Learn to Read, and people said, oh, how'd you think of that name? I'm like, it's my name. But, you know, we think of best, we think of there's nothing better. It's the ultimate. It's unique. You know, of course, we use the word unique rather casually also. Uni means one. But spiritually, you can have a lot of best devotees. If we think about it, Sanatana Goswami, also in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, he says, each cowherd boy thinks I am Krishna's favorite, and each cowherd boy is Krishna's favorite.
So that's the absolute world, that you can have lots of best devotees. You can have lots of Krishna's favorite. You know, when Krishna's sitting surrounded by the cowherd boys, each cowherd boy thinks Krishna's just talking to me. Right? Each gopi thinks, you know, each gopi thinks Krishna's only dancing with me in Rasleela. Or Krishna's only sitting on my cloth by the Yamuna. You know, this is the amazing feature of Krishna. So Govardhan Hill is one of the best devotees. Who's the best devotee? Of course, Govardhan Hill is Krishna as a devotee. So, of course, this reminds us of Lord Chaitanya, who's Krishna as a devotee. It's quite a similar idea, Krishna taking the role of his devotees. So why is Govardhan called the best devotee? Oh, my friends, Radharani again is saying to her friends, this hill supplies Krishna and Balaram, along with their cows, and cowherd friends, with all kinds of necessities. So this is, it isn't a great projector, but it'll do. It's not like vibrant, but it's got all accurate colors and it's fine. So now we're seeing the criteria, what makes somebody a best devotee. You serve the devotees. We talked about this in Manashiksha, right? Getting rid of that pride that I'm a great devotee. If you really want to be a great devotee, you don't think of yourself as a great devotee, but you serve the great devotees. That's the irony. I mean, like Jesus said, those who try to find their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. You know, if we're trying to become a great devotee, all we're doing is we're, you know, having this unfaithful woman eating a dead dog in our heart. And if we want to serve the great devotees, then we actually become a great devotee. But we never think we're a great devotee. Can you get your head around that? We just think, oh, I'm so happy to be the servant. So what kind of necessities does Govardhan provide? Now you'll notice that Govardhan is providing all these from his own body. It's not like he's going to the shop and getting something. You know, he's providing them directly, which is another reason why he's called the best devotee. Okay, so water for drinking. Fragrant, cool water from the Govardhan waterfalls, which Krishna and Balaram use to drink and to wash their feet and mouths. I remember I showed this presentation once in New Zealand on Govardhan Puja, and one of the newer people said, can we go see this place in India? I said, well, it doesn't quite look like this anymore. Other beverages besides water, like honey, mango juice, and pilu juice. You can come in. Oh, okay. Hey, what time do you usually make an offering? Sorry, I think there's only a few people here. We can be a little casual. Okay, so Govardhan is supplying honey, mango juice, and pilu juice. And if you go to Govardhan today, you see mostly thorn trees. There's a few sections where you'll find fruit trees. Fragrant soft grass for feeding the transcendental herds. And again, we see this nowadays mostly in and after the monsoon season. Caves where Krishna and Balaram and their friends can play and sit and lie down. These caves give pleasure when the weather is too hot or too cold or when it's raining. Govardhan also has soft roots for eating, jewels for decorating the body. You don't have to have mines, you know. You don't have to make people go, you know, a couple kilometers underground and almost die. But the jewels are just sitting on the top of Govardhan Hill. You just pick them up. Flat places for sitting. I always really liked it when I could make a picture like this. It's a combination of a photograph and a painting. That's actually a photograph of Govardhan. And then a painting of Govardhan. I really enjoy it when I can do that. Being touched by the lotus feet of Krishna and Balaram, Govardhan Hill appears very jubilant. Does anyone know where these deities are?
Botswana.
No, I've never been to Botswana. They have Krishna Balaram deities in Botswana. These are in France, in a place called New Mayapur. And this outfit is their spring outfit. So they have four seasonal outfits. They have a spring, summer, fall, and winter outfit. And for each outfit, the outfits in the backdrop are decorated with the flowers, etc., of the seasons. And it basically looks like Krishna and Balaram walked through that seasonal forest and had the flowers and bits stuck to their clothes as they walked through. The deities are just taken for it very nicely. Now, you have some indication in this photograph that this is a very, very poor temple. Can anyone see the evidence that it's an extremely poor temple?
The garlands?
The garlands are just made out of leaves. It's one of those farm projects that was purchased very far away from any place, and in Bhagavan's time was a flourishing community, and now is almost a dead community, and the whole property is falling apart and so forth. It's a very sad situation. But the deities are taken care of with a lot of devotion. There's Gorni Thai, Krishna Balaram, and Radha Krishna. And the head pujari, I don't know if she still is, but she was a head pujari there for more than 30 years. And she told me the story that, I don't know, within the last 10 years, that Indradyumna Swami, he used to live there. There used to be a big school there when Indradyumna Swami was a grahastha. He and his wife lived there, and his wife was very involved in the school. And she said that when he visited, that he came right into the temple room, and she and her husband were also there, and they're looking at the deities. And she said, all of a sudden, all the deities were alive. And she thought, you know, what is that? And she said, a week later, her husband said to her, did you notice anything in the temple room when Indradyumna Swami was here looking at the deities? So he had also had that darshan of the deities. So the deities, they're very present, and they're taken care of with a lot of love and devotion, even though the community is extremely poor with a skeleton staff, etc. If you ever get a chance to go to Europe, and you have a chance to go to New Mayapur, I mean, it's way out of the way. It's like a 4-hour drive from Paris. The deity is really extraordinary. So Govardhan Hill is very happy being touched by the lotus feet of Krishna and Balaram. So again, that's what makes us a nice servant. Usually if somebody touches us with their feet, we become offended. You know, but Govardhan's very happy, oh, Krishna's touching me. You know, we have great devotees like Uddhava who want to be grass in Vrindavan, or Lord Brahma who says, I'll even be grass right outside Vrindavan. So the devotees, the Lord and the devotees will... Krishna's on me with his feet. So Govardhan Hill in this way shows us how to render pure devotional service, and therefore the devotees pray to Govardhan. So this is the standard prayer of the devotees. I want to live near Govardhan. I want to have my residence by Govardhan. Okay, now we're going to get to the story of Govardhan Puja. So Krishna saw that his father and the cowherd men were making a big sacrifice, and he said to his father, what's the purpose of this sacrifice? Why are you doing it? Is it just a tradition? Is it in the Vedas? And these sort of questions are extremely important. Extremely important. One of the ways I was trained in the early days of ISKCON was always ask, what's the praman? What's the evidence? People say all kinds of things. I mean, when devotee had a discussion with me a few days ago about Gurukula, and he was saying how, you know, you have to be a real Gurukula, it has to be a boarding school. And I said, but Lord Chaitanya ran a day school. You know, you're going to say he didn't run the God himself wasn't the teacher in a bona fide school, you know, does it have to be a boarding school? And he said, well, that's true. He said, but Prabhupada emphasized boarding school. I said, okay, you know, that's true. And then he said, well, the reason is that the boys need to get away from their families in order to learn austerity. And then he said, you know, if there was a community... Oh, and I kept pushing about homeschooling. I said, homeschooling is really nice. Prabhupada also liked homeschooling. And then he said, well, a real gurukul is a homeschool. I said, well, that would be true if the gurukul is run by a family and there's just a small number of students. But most of our boarding schools haven't been like that. And then he said, yeah, he said, and in Vedic times, if there were two brahmanas in a village who ran a school, they would teach other people's kids, but they wouldn't teach their own sons. They would exchange their sons between the two schools. So I said to him, what's your praman for that? Where are you getting this from? He said, can you give me one instance in any of the scriptures where brahmanas exchanged their boys if they ran a school? I said, Dronacharya taught his own son, Asvatthama. Sandipani Muni taught his own son. You know, give me evidence. Then he says, oh, I don't know, I'll get back to you, and he hasn't gotten back to me. So this is the this it's a very important question to ask, and one can ask it very respectfully. You know, one can say, oh, Maharaj, that is a wonderful point. I'm so enlivened. Could you tell me the source for that, please? You know, when Prabhupada was here, many times devotees would say, oh, Prabhupada said. And Prabhupada said, don't believe Prabhupada said. You know, you have to be able to find a source. And then there, you have to understand the reason for what you're doing. And Krishna really emphasized to Nanda Maharaj, sacrifice performed in knowledge, this is also in the Bhagavad Gita, that a sacrifice performed in knowledge is much more effective than a sacrifice performed without knowledge. We should know, why am I chanting Hare Krishna? Why am I worshipping the deities? Why am I eating prasadam? And we should know the scientific basis for how it works. I'm having a lengthy discussion right now with several devotees about what does it really mean that Krishna is his name. How do we explain this? How do we explain that Krishna manifests when you chant? What does it mean to chant properly? And I was just hearing a lecture where Prabhupada was saying, if you chant properly, so what exactly does that mean? How do we explain it? How does Krishna manifest in sound? And it's important to understand these things. Otherwise, what happens is, on an institutional level, we institute many things that are not actually in the Shastra. And that's already happened. There's many things that go on in ISKCON that we teach people as rules that are not coming from Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. But they become established traditions. So this is kind of what Krishna was asking. Is this just something traditional? A gentleman was asking me this in Linasia. He teaches in a school, and he says, you know, what do I say to my students who say, well, killing a cow at a wedding is our tradition? So therefore we have to do it because it's tradition. And I said, well, you know, every tradition has things in it which are bad. I said, you know, look at the European culture tradition. Their tradition was to go and colonize places where people already lived. You know, if you want to colonize some uninhabited land, you know, we go to some place where there's already people there. And oh, by the way, we're taking over your country. And we're going to exploit all of you, and we're going to steal all your resources. That was the European tradition, am I correct? For hundreds of years. So what are we going to say? Oh, well, that's your tradition, so that's cool. You know, whatever your tradition is, that's okay. You know, you want to colonize people and enslave them? Okay, fine. You know, you want to kill cows at your wedding? Okay, fine. So just because something is traditional doesn't make it good. And Krishna was making this point to Nanda Maharaj. Is this just some tradition? Or is this something given in the Shastra? What's its purpose? Why are you doing what you're doing? Where does it come from? And this is something, I mean, I remember asking my mother this when I was 4 years old. I said to my mother, why are we Jewish? She said, because my mother's Jewish. I said, why is your mother Jewish? She said, because her mother's Jewish. I said, why is she Jewish? Because her mother's Jewish. I was just 4 years old. I said, that's not right. I said, we should do something because it's true, not just because our mother did it. Do you all know the story of the cat? With the Aarti? You all know the story of the cat at the Aarti? So in India, because it's a tropical country, so many of the temples just have a roof and pillars. There's no walls. And so at one of these temples, during an Aarti one day, a cat came in. And the cat started crying to go on the altar because the prasadam was still on the altar. And so it was a temple where there was a guru with some disciples, and the guru said to his disciples, just tie up the cat, and after the artik, when we take the tray off, then we can feed the cat. So the cat, having been fed, came back the next day at the same time. And it became a habit that every day the cat came, and every day they tied it up during the artik, and then after the artik, they untied the cat and they fed it. So then the guru died. And sometime after that, the cat died. And then the disciples decided, well, we have to get another cat, because it's essential during the artik that we tie up a cat. So this is exactly how things happen, and there's a lot of things that go on in a Hare Krishna movement that are in that category that just became some tradition, and then everybody thinks this is what we're supposed to do. So Nanda Maharaj says, well, the reason that we're doing this sacrifice is that we're agriculturalists. We're particularly a cow herding community, and If we don't have rain, how are the cows going to live? How are we going to do our business? And Indra supplies the rain, and therefore it's our tradition to thank Indra. So of course, this is actually in the Shastra, that one should perform yajna for the demigods. And in fact, Krishna talks about this in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, that the demigods are supplying everything, and therefore you propitiate them with yajna. But Krishna didn't like this idea that people were worshiping demigods directly. Krishna wants the demigods propitiated through him. And Srila Prabhupada compares the worship of to worshiping the demigods directly to bribing government officials. You know, the idea is, you know, and all right, Krishna. But the idea is, you're supposed to pay your taxes to the government, and then the government distributes those taxes to the government servants. You're not supposed to be paying bribes to, you know, the individual people. Although there are such sacrifices mentioned for materialistic people. So it's very interesting here that Krishna said, Indra can't change anybody's destiny. Why should you worship him? And Krishna spoke in an atheistic way to his father. He said, everything is just by your good work and your good karma. There's no need to get personal about this. You don't have to get personal with the demigods. They're just doing what they're supposed to do. You don't need a personal relationship with them. They're doing what they have to do. Imagine if somebody said that about you. If someone said, you know, you don't have to be nice to Itu. You don't have to be nice to Itu Malang. She's just doing what she has to do. It's just her job. Whether you're nice to her or you're not nice to her, she still has to do her job. How would you feel? Awful. Because even if something's our job, we're still doing it voluntarily, isn't it? We should always, 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 always remember that everyone is always doing everything voluntarily. There's no should. There's no must. We all have a choice. Always. We're voluntarily chanting our rounds every day. We've taken a vow, but it's still voluntary every day. You know, I see this harms marital relationships when people think, my wife has to do this, my husband has to do this because, you know, we're married. Okay. But it's still voluntary. We voluntarily entered into the agreement. We voluntarily fulfill our agreement every day. And Krishna and Prabhupada made this point. He said, the manager should be very careful to maintain the spirit of enthusiastic service, which is individual, spontaneous, and voluntary. One of Gopi Pranandana Prabhu's favorite quotes. So Krishna was basically saying here that Indra's not doing things voluntarily and you don't need to have a personal relationship with him. It's just, everything's just sort of mechanical. He said there's rules in the universe and you follow the rules and then you just get the result. And the demigods are just sort of part of the machine. Now, what I find particularly interesting about this part of the Shastra is that we are told by Srila Prabhupada and by our acharyas not to accept this philosophy that is spoken directly by God. That we should not accept as absolute truth nor live by this philosophy that Krishna himself is speaking in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And this is one of many examples which show that we cannot take the scriptures as every word in the scriptures as literally absolutely true out of context. So I'm having a discussion with this with a devotee who's talking about some of Prabhupada's statements that he finds uncomfortable for him and uncomfortable in his preaching. And I find that many devotees try to deal with this by relativizing some of the statements of the scriptures or disregarding them. But this is one of the offenses on chanting. You know, to disrespect the Shastras or to disobey the Guru. So how do we take it that every statement in the Shastra and every statement of the Acharyas is absolutely perfect and true? And yet have this section of the Bhagavatam spoken by God? That we say, no, 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 this is not actually the proper philosophy. So my understanding is everything is absolutely perfectly true in context. Things are contextual. One of the items of knowledge is knowing context, knowing what is taught proper time, place, and circumstance. And the other is acting according to that. So there are very, 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 very few statements in the Shastra by the Acharyas that are transcontextual. There are a few statements that are going to be absolutely perfectly true in every context, to everyone, all the time. And most statements are absolutely totally perfectly true and wonderful in certain contexts. Does this make sense to everybody? We just read a verse like this in the Bhagavatam the other day, where Prabhupada was talking about in different ages, there's different forms of sacrifice. Remember that? And he said, even in different countries, at the present times, there's different forms of sacrifice. But the essence of sacrifice, remember what he said was the essence of sacrifice?
Truthfulness.
So truthfulness is a transcontextual principle. But the specific forms of sacrifice are contextual. The specific way you manifest truthfulness and connect with the divine changes. And so the instruction is perfect and true in context. We have a lot of statements in the Bhagavatam about processes of bhakti that we don't follow. The Prabhupada will say, this is for a different age. Correct? In the Bhagavad Gita. You know, Krishna gave that whole instruction to Arjuna about going off to the forest and sitting on deerskin. And Arjuna never followed that instruction. So this is a very important point. And we can assume that the majority of the instructions in the Shastras and by the Acharyas are contextual. The vast majority of them have to be understood in context. Who's speaking? Who are they speaking to? What's going on? And there's really only a few that are absolutely applicable to everyone, everywhere. I mean, take another example, where Krishna is telling Arjuna, get up and fight. Is that a transcontextual instruction? How absurd would that be? That would be absurd. Just imagine if all of us walked around with bows and arrows fighting everybody all the time. You know what I mean? We look at what's the principle. Okay, there's... And behind the contextual instructions, there are also eternal principles. So in every contextual instruction, there is some transcontextual principle. But the details of the instruction may be contextual. So what's the principle to Arjuna? Whatever you're doing, do with proper consciousness in the divine. Follow your nature. We can look at all these transcontextual principles underneath that get up and fight. And once we understand that, then we no longer have to minimize anything in the scripture or push away anything in the scripture or say, you know, well, or look at Prabhupada's purports, like I know some devotees do, and they'll look at Prabhupada's purports and say, well, this sentence, that really just came from Prabhupada's upbringing. And this sentence we follow, and this sentence we're just going to relativize that it was Prabhupada's culture. You don't have to do that when you understand that everything Prabhupada says is, I mean, Jamuna would say this, everything Prabhupada says is perfect. But it's perfect in that context. Does that make sense to everybody? So this is a very interesting section of the Bhagavatam. And then Krishna says, look, instead of worshipping Indra, Indra's not really doing anything for us. Why don't we worship Govardhan? Govardhan's really doing something for us. Now, normally, I don't think that an intelligent, capable person like Nanda Maharaj, who was the king of thousands or hundreds of thousands or maybe even millions of people. He was a Vaishya king. As you may know, Nanda Maharaj and Vasudev are half-brothers. They have the same father and different mothers. That their father was Kshatriya and Nanda Maharaj's mother was a Vaishya and Vasudev's mother was Kshatriya. The concept that a woman automatically takes on the varna of her husband is not supported by the Shastra. And often, if there was a mixed varna marriage, the children would be more identified with the varna of the mother than the father. We find that with Vidura. We find that with Ramaharshan. So Nanda Maharaj was identified as a Vaishya from his mother and Vasudeva as a Kshatriya from his mother. But Nanda Maharaj, even though he was a Vaishya, he was a king among the Vaishyas. He was kind of on the border, you could say. So I don't think somebody like this, who's vastly intelligent and learned and capable, is normally going to agree to worship a hill instead of a demigod. You know, we in fact, we think about worshiping natural landmarks as the behavior of tribals, isn't it? You know, in tribal society, they'll say, okay, we're going to worship the river, we're going to worship the hill, we're going to, you know. And then a little higher than that, you're worshiping the deities of the personalities of the place. So it's sort of astonishing that Nandamarj agrees to this. Now, at first, of course, he says, okay, Krishna, but let's do Indra's sacrifice first. We'll do a separate sacrifice for Govardhan. And then Krishna says, no, that'll take too long. Let's just take everything you had prepared for Indra and offer it to Govardhan. Why does Nandamarj agree?
As far as I remember in the Krishna book, he's like almost just melted.
Yes, exactly.
Krishna's...
Exactly.
That's my boy.
Yes. Yes. Now, materially, this is very unfavorable. Materially, to put aside logic and reason and tradition for hundreds of thousands of people and huge amounts of money because your little boy asks you something would be very unfavorable. But spiritually, it's very favorable when that little boy is God. And this is the interesting thing. You know, we see this with Mother Yasoda and Krishna, with the pearl planting pastime. Are you familiar with this? When Krishna asks his mother, can I have your pearls to plant them? Now, at a material level, that would have to be a very indulgent mother to take. Pearls are expensive. And these were not cultured pearls. These were real pearls. You don't find real pearls very many places in the world anymore. In Bahrain, they don't allow cultured pearls in the country. You can't even bring cultured pearls in the country because they only have genuine pearls. And my grandson and I saw a pearl necklace in a shop in Bahrain that was worth $500,000 U.S. dollars. So you have pearls like that and you're going to let your kid plant them in the ground? You know, who would do this? And he just says, please, Mommy. And she says, okay. So we can think of the upside-down banyan tree. That things that are not nice in this world are wonderful in the spiritual world. To just have your heart melt and have your emotion overcome your logic and discretion is a feature of bhakti. It's a feature of love. And by the way, this is the reason, my understanding, of the reason why Srila Prabhupada said that women are less intelligent. Because materially speaking, women are much more prone to doing this than men. Generally. I mean, I've met certain men who are much more like this than certain women. So if you look at an individual basis, there are many men whose emotions overcome their intelligence frequently, and many women whose intelligence generally overcomes their emotions frequently. But overall, women tend to be more guided by their emotions. We call this being soft-hearted. Like you say, this heart melts. We call women being very soft-hearted. That women will do things out of emotional reasons, even when their intelligence tells them something different. So materially, that's not a very good thing. But spiritually, that's the best thing. And this is one of the ways in which having a human female form makes bhakti easier. Because we can take something that materially is a problem, but when we use it in bhakti, it becomes glorious. And you kind of asked this question about, you know, if I'm really into the mind, is that going to be an impediment? And that is one of the two main impediments of having a male body. That it's harder to melt your heart. You can't have a resistance to it more in a male body. In a female body, it's fair. Of course, nowadays, women are raised to be more like men, and who knows what's going on in modern society. But we're trying to, in modern society, unfeminize women, isn't it? You know, and the women, you know, tough. Yeah, they're tough. Draupadi was a pretty tough woman. But although Draupadi was a very tough woman, she was a Kshatrani. When she saw Asvatthama, her heart melted. And she said, he had just killed 5 of her children in their sleep. And she said, aw, don't kill him. This is his mother's only child, and her husband died in the battle. If you kill him, his mother will be crying like I'm crying. She was crying for the mother of the murder of her kids. And Prabhupada writes in the purport this was due to her lack of discretion as a soft-hearted woman. And she was a tough lady. I mean, she was a really tough lady. She was a warrior woman. So this is the general mood in bhakti, even with Nanda Maharaj. There's a general mood in bhakti is this melting heart. And I think, you know, we tend as conditioned souls, we tend to be afraid of our heart melting because we're afraid that then I'll just be, you know, conned by somebody. But it's fine to be conned by Krishna. Don't be conned by people in the world. But it's fine to be conned by Krishna. And that's exactly what Krishna is doing here to Nanda Maharaj. He's speaking some atheistic philosophy and just charming him. And Nanda Maharaj says, okay, I love you. Whatever you want. That's beautiful. By the way, that is what we all want to do. We resist it in this world, but everyone, men included, we all want to do that. We all want our heart to be melted in love for someone. And we want to be able to give that person we love whatever they want. That's what we're desiring to do. A man wants to do that for a woman and wants to do that for his children. I mean, it's not that we don't want to do that, but doing that for another conditioned soul is very dangerous. Okay, then Krishna tells what to do. He said, okay, now I'm going to tell you how to do the sacrifice. How old was Krishna, by the way?
8.
Yeah, 7 or 8 years old. He's a little kid. If you think of some 7, 8-year-old kid that you know. So now he's telling all the brahmanas. You know, he's telling all the brahmanas and all the Vaishya leaders what to do. He says, okay, let a lot of different kinds of food be cooked, from sweet rice to vegetable soup. And the brahmanas have to invoke the sacred fires, feed the priests, reward them with cows and other gifts. After giving food to everyone else, including fallen souls like dogs and dog eaters, then give grass to the cows. And then present your respectful offerings to Govardhan Hill. So Krishna's giving the whole plan here. You know, again, think of in what community would a little kid be dictating everything to the elders. And this was a traditional community. You know, where they had very clear sense of hierarchy and seniors and juniors. He says, dress and decorate yourselves handsomely. And then circumambulate the cows, the brahmanas, the sacrificial fires, and Govardhan Hill. So this idea of dressing up for a festival. Now, this is something given by Krishna himself, that when there's a big festival, and both the men and the women would dress themselves very, very opulently. So why do you do this? It creates a festive atmosphere, doesn't it? So you notice we have a photograph there. I don't know how well you can see that photograph. This is from our Gurukul in North Carolina. So, and it was this was the start of my journey of my own personal relationship with Govardhan. And I don't know if I have time. Do I have time? Can I go a little late?
Yeah.
Should I tell you a personal story?
Yeah.
Okay. This is another sort of embarrassing story. But it was very instructive for me. So when we moved to North Carolina, it was a very small temple. And as it came to Govardhan Puja, they were going to have the festival only on the closest Sunday. So I went to the temple president, Bir Krishna Swami, and I said, you can't have no festival on the actual day. And only a festival on Sunday. So you have to worship Govardhan on the actual day, or you're going to get bitten by the snakes. And he said, well, we don't have enough manpower to do 2 festivals. I said, but you have to. And he said, well, you know, you can do one if you want. And we were already running the Gurukul. He said, you can do one at the Gurukul. I said, okay, but you have to come. I said, you and all the temple devotees have to come. So he said, okay. So we started doing a festival on Govardhan Puja. And what we would do is we would make a hill out of paper mache. You know what paper mache is? And then the kids would decorate it. And I decided to really get into it and make it something very special for the kids. So we would work on it for 2 to 4 weeks in advance. And some years we made one hill for the whole school. Some years the older children made a hill and the younger children made a hill. Some years each child made a hill or groups of children made a hill. So we had to make all different things. And then... if it was nice weather, as you can see there was, we would have the festival outside, and it was usually in the middle of the day, so a lot of the devotees couldn't come, but any of the devotees who could come in the middle of the day, and all the temple devotees would come, and there you see Bhaktitirtha Swami. You see him at the festival, going around the hill. So what was particularly interesting about this is that, and first the temple had a cow, and they would also bring the cow, was that my initial motive for doing this Govardhan Puja Festival at the Gurukul was basically just criticism and envy. You know, why aren't the temple leaders doing the right thing? I know better than them. Why are they in charge and not me? Kind of thing, you understand? That was my initial motivation, with a little bit of, we should do the right thing to please Srila Prabhupada. There was maybe 5% of that, 5% of a desire to please Prabhupada, and 95% just a critical, envious mentality. And then as I got into it, I got into it for the children. So certainly after the first year, it wasn't so much just criticizing the temple. It was something, oh, let's make something nice for the children. And let's have this a really memorable festival for the children, like the way most kids think about Christmas. And after doing it for 9 years, on one Govardhan Puja festival, Bir Krishna Swami called me up and said, Urmila, there's a devotee here who's abandoned his Govardhan Shila. And the house at whom, where the Shila was abandoned, the devotee there doesn't want to take care of him. Will you please take care of him? And I said, no. And Bir Krishna Swami had always been preaching against devotees worshipping Shilas. He's saying, you know, it's too high of a standard to worship, too many offenses, don't do it. So I said, you're always telling people not to worship Shilas. Why are you now asking me to worship a Govardhan Shila? And he says, no, I really want you to take it. He kept pressing and pressing. And I said, okay, you're the GBC, you know, I'll take him. And that's how I got my Govardhan Shila. And then he came on Govardhan Puja in 2000. So we did a whole Abhishek for Giriraj. And I remember, you know, Bir Krishna Swami was so hesitant to have Shila worship. I said, can we put him on the altar for the temple's festival? He said, no, I don't want any Shilas on the altar. And I said, look, just one day. And then I thought, well, when I go to Vrindavan in February, I'll put him back on the hill. And then I forgot to do that. The day I went to Govardhan, I forgot to take him. And when I came back to my room, there he was. And I thought, okay, I guess I'm keeping you. I just couldn't understand. How did I get a Govardhan Shila? It didn't make any sense to me. And it was maybe in that April or so, I was saying that to someone, and the devotee looked at me and said, you've been worshipping Govardhan for 9 years. Why are you surprised that he came? I hadn't made the connection at all. Then later on, my son-in-law was invited to manage Gopi Pranadana Prabhu's Sanskrit school at a Govardhan. So my daughter and son-in-law and their daughter moved to Govardhan. And because they're disciples of Bir Krishna Swami, he would visit them in Govardhan. So he got very attached to Govardhan. Now they all worship Govardhan Shilas. And now our family runs a project where every day we do cleaning at Govardhan, restoration of the temple. Did I show that video here? The Radhakund project, yeah. So within that became our project, was serving, of course Radhakund's part of Govardhan, serving the whole Radhakund Govardhan area. We all became Govardhan Bhaktas. And it started from my having a critical, envious mentality towards Bir Krishna Maharaj in regard to worshipping Govardhan. Is that interesting? I find that very interesting. So this verse in the Brahma Samhita, Yam Krodha Kama Sahaja Pranayani Bhitti Vatsalya Moha Guru Gaurava Sevya Bhavai Sanchinchitasam Sadrisim Tanam Operate. Any emotion that we have, that we're using in worship, will purify us. My decision to have the Govardhan Festival was an emotional one. There was a little bit of logic in Shastra, but most of it was emotional. And because it was emotional, first out of envy, and then out of affection for the children, Govardhan reciprocated and turned it into something else. Isn't that interesting? When we stay on the platform of just, you know, philosophy, that doesn't happen. But as soon as we have some emotion involved, you know, Krishna enjoys Mother Yasoda getting angry with him. Now, obviously, we shouldn't be envious. That's not recommended. but any emotion. And so it was just kind of interesting personal story. So that's a photograph of one of the festivals when Bhakti Tirtha Swami was visiting. It was always a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful festival. At least my envy didn't last long then. Maybe just the first year. Then Krishna declared, I am Govardhan Mountain. And Govardhan Mountain manifested as Krishna. And there were two Krishnas. There was the Krishna there with everybody worshipping Govardhan. And then there was Govardhan as Krishna. So it was this Krishna worshipping himself. Right? So then the devotees are circumambulating Govardhan. And as they do that, they sing this song from the Gopal Champu. Quote from Krishna book. The identity of Krishna in Govardhan Hill is still honored, and great devotees take rocks from Govardhan Hill and worship them exactly as they worship the deity of Krishna in the temple. The followers of the Krishna consciousness movement may therefore collect small rocks or pebbles from Govardhan Hill and worship them at home, because this worship is as good as deity worship. And there's Lord Chaitanya's Govardhan Shila, which of course was given to Raghunath Das Goswami, Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Govardhan Shila. When I've been at our farm in Hungary at New Vrajdam for Govardhan Puja, as they circumambulate, they have a Govardhan Shila, as they circumambulate him in the temple room, they sing that song, and they take turns, like the men will ask the question, and the women will answer, and the women will ask the question, and the men will answer. It is so much fun.
What's the name of that song?
It's from Gopal Champu. I don't think it has a name. When Jiva Goswami wrote Gopal Champu, he put many songs in it. So throughout the book, there's songs.
Who did this rendition?
This is by my godbrother, Javi, who's a Grammy Award winner.
Is it Ian Chesty?
Yes. And he has, I don't know if he still does, but he has a house at Govardhan. In fact, he was our neighbor at Govardhan for a long time. So yeah, he produced that. Beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah,
there's another production that was done. Bhanu Swami's produced a translation of Gopal Champu, and there's a CD that comes with that translation that has a different rendition of this, but I like this one a lot better.
Just see the impudence of the inhabitants of Vrindavan. They are simply inhabitants of the forest, but being infatuated with their friend Krishna, who is nothing but an ordinary human being, they have dared to defy the demigods.
All right, here's the typical response of an egotistical person. I have been offended. I have been insulted. And Indra says, they've defied the demigods. No, they didn't. They defied you. So we often do this. We don't want to make it obvious that it's personal, that we've been insulted. So we talk about it as if it's some sort of principle. Right? Well, no, it's not about me. It's not my ego. But these people there defying the whole Vedic tradition and all the demigods, and therefore they have to be punished to bring them back into line. I don't. Daksha said this at the sacrifice when he insulted Lord Shiva. He said, "I'm not speaking out of ignorance or envy."
Go and I shall follow you, riding on my elephant. Great storms will come with me to give the proper punishment. For down the range you great storm clouds, they should be destroyed along with their cows.
And now Indra's way overreacting. This is what happens when we feel that we've been insulted. Way overreacting. He's called for the Samvartika clouds that destroy the universe to deal with what he feels is insubordination from a village. Oh, the clouds blaze with lightning bolts and they roared with thunder as they hurl down hailstones. As the clouds released torrents of rain as thick as massive columns, the earth was submerged in the flood. This would be like if you thought someone insulted you at the temple and you tried to burn down the property. So the cows and the other animals, they were shivering, and the cowherd men and ladies, they all approach Govinda for shelter. So this is also, again, very interesting. Materially speaking, you would not ask a little 8-year-old child to save the village. But this was their mood. So this is, we had this question yesterday about Yogamaya. You know, so the residents of Vrindavan, they understand that Krishna is my shelter, even though at the same time they see him as a little boy. So Krishna says, by my mystic power, I will completely counteract this disturbance caused by Indra. When I break the false prestige of those bereft of goodness, my purpose is to bring them relief. We were talking last night about goodness, right? And about that people may say, well, I'm happy doing what I'm doing. But real happiness is in goodness or bhakti. And so when Krishna sees that somebody is in ignorance or passion, he tries to bring them to goodness. And especially a demigod like Indra, who's supposed to be in goodness. So when Krishna sees, wait, one of my servants is messing up and he's in Rajagun, or in this case, Tamagun. This is Tamagun. This is the mode of ignorance. Somebody does something and I take it as a personal insult. I immediately interpret it as a personal insult. I justify my taking it that way by saying, no, they've offended some big principle. And then I way overreact in my response to the other person. You know, I do a reaction that's 1,000 times more than what I feel I was insulted. So Krishna says, I must protect the cowherd community, for I am their shelter, their master, and they are my own family. This is another time where we put together a photograph of Govardhan with a painting. So interesting. So if there was a flood, would you think, caused by Indra, would you think that the response would be to pick up a mountain? Maybe you'd think the response would be everybody to go on the mountain and get on higher ground, but to pick up the mountain and have it as an umbrella for the rain. So Krishna has interesting solutions to problems. He could have paralyzed Indra's arm. That's what Chaivana Muni did. Paralyze Indra's vajra-throwing arm. Krishna could have done that. Could have just killed Indra. I mean, so many things he could have done. Could have put him to sleep like he did with Lord Shiva in the fight with Banasura. So there's so many things that Krishna could have done. But Krishna let Indra go ahead and do whatever he wanted to do. He did not stop Indra. He just let him rant. Okay, throw everything at me. Go ahead. He didn't stop him. He said, display your power. Now, it's interesting because this helped Indra to come to his own realization. When we have problems in life, please remember that Krishna is always going to solve them, but he's not necessarily going to solve them in the way you have in your head that he should solve them. You might think Krishna should just, you know, dry up the flood and make Indra go away immediately. But he doesn't. He allows the devastation to take place. And he tells everybody, O mother, O father, O residents of Raja, if you wish, you may now come under this hill with your cows. If you wish, it's always voluntary. Now, again, would you do that? Would you go under a mountain that's being held by a little boy? And the mood that the residents of Vrindavan have that they do this is quite fascinating. So Vishnu Chakravarti says this. I think either he or Kavi Kanapur, I can't remember. Maybe it's Kavi Kanapur. I think it's Kavi Kanapur, Nanda Vrindavan Champu. He says, ordinary, a large cowherd community which included many thousands of cows, calves, bulls, and so on, would not fit under the base of a medium-sized hill like Sri Govardhan. However, because the hill was in ecstasy, being touched by the hand of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, it acquired inconceivable power and even felt the hundreds of deadly thunderbolts thrown upon its back by angry Indra to be offerings of soft, fragrant flowers. At times, Sri Govardhan was not even aware that the thunderbolts were striking. By the way, this is the method by which we become free from material miseries. It's not that we become free from material miseries necessarily by Krishna removing the miseries themselves, which he may do. He might do that. But because we are no longer aware of them as miseries. We may be aware of them. Govardhan was aware that Indra was throwing lightning at him. But he didn't experience it as lightning. In fact, he experienced it as flowers. So when our consciousness changes, we do not experience pain as pain. We experience pain as something interesting, but not as pain. We do not feel pain as pain. And I experienced this in my second and third labors, where after reading in Teachings of the Lord Kapila, where Prabhupada says that even a materialistic man can meditate in such a way that he won't be disturbed by a surgical operation. So I practiced just meditating on the deities. And I didn't feel any pain. I felt, my uterus is contracting like this. And I could feel everything happening in my body, but it was just kind of interesting. And it wasn't even slightly painful, it was just interesting. And this is the principle, that the devotee is in so much happiness being absorbed in the Lord that they don't experience pain as pain. They don't see it like this. I mean, when Kunti's saying, let calamities happening again, she's not some masochist saying, I want to suffer. She doesn't experience it as suffering. She just says, oh, here's an opportunity for Krishna to come knocking on my door. By continuously drinking the nectar of the beauty and sweetness of Krishna, the residents of Vrindavan felt no hunger, thirst, or fatigue. And Lord Krishna, by seeing their beautiful forms, also forgot about eating, drinking, and sleeping. Of course, this is one of the few leelas where everybody in Vrindavan is together, all seeing Krishna at the same time. I mean, there's another one with the Kaliya leela, but that's a little intensely emotional for everybody. And another one, Krishna leaves for Mathura, that's another reel, that's even more intense. But this, I mean, even though there was this flood going on around them, the devotees were not bothered by it. And they were just so happy to be with Krishna. So this is... The Govardhan Puja Festival is a very, very happy festival, even though there's a part of it that's pretty intense for the residents of Vrindavan. During the flood stage, before they go under the hill, you know, your houses are being flooded and you're going to die. I mean, that's another thing. You know, when you surrender to Krishna, they surrender to Krishna and did Govardhan Puja instead of Indra Puja. It's not that everything just worked out materially sweet. Often we think the evidence of whether I've surrendered to Krishna and the evidence of whether Krishna is pleased is that everything materially is going to work out all right. And if it didn't, I figure Krishna's not pleased. That's not true. They surrendered to Krishna, they did what he asked, and their village got flooded. Of course, in the end, it was all okay. Like I told the devotees when we were stuck in the wild animal reserve. You know, first we got stuck in the mud, then our tire blew out, and the 7-year-old kid was crying. I said, in the end, it will all be okay, and if it's not okay, it's not the end. You know, and when you're surrendered to Krishna, the end is always good. But there may be some, you know, because it's an adventure, and it's Leela. Now, it's interesting that Ananda Vrindavan Champu, Kavi Kanapur says, that Krishna created a whole heavenly planet under Govardhan Hill. There was like a whole other town of Vrindavan under Govardhan Hill. But the way the Bhagavatam describes it is simply everybody was under the hill and they forgot about eating, drinking, and sleeping for 1 week. They didn't feel hunger. They didn't feel thirst. Not like if we do a fast and we feel hunger and thirst, but we deal with it. But they didn't even feel it, and nor did Krishna. Of course, you know, the Goswamis talk about how Mother Yasoda was really worried that Krishna wasn't eating. And she was really worried that his left hand was going to get tired. And, you know, and the cowherd boys also, they're saying, can we help you? And so Indra became very astonished. Now, it took 7 days for him to be astonished. And he was going on and on and on and on. And doesn't Krishna deal with us like this too? You know, we're doing something just out of pride and false ego, and Krishna deals with us in this very extraordinary way. And finally we go, oh. So then Indra stopped his storm, and Krishna said, my dear cowherd men, please go out with your wives, children, and possessions. And everything in Vrindavan was as it was originally. There wasn't some big flood damage. You didn't have to get out, you know, the emergency control system of the government or something. That doesn't always happen. There's a pastime with Lord Chaitanya that he asked his mother for a garland to worship the Ganga. And she said, okay, in just a moment. He said, no, I want it now. She said, I can't, just take me a minute, just give me a minute. And he had a fit and he destroyed the whole house. You talk about a temper tantrum. He destroyed the whole house and then he was tired and he lay down and went to sleep. And when he woke up, Mother Sachi said to him, Jagannath Mishra had already passed from the world. Mother Sachi said to him, no, look, this is your house. If it gives you more pleasure to destroy it than to have it, it's your house, you can do whatever you love. Just imagine that kind of surrendered mood. She said, but how am I going to cook your lunch? I no longer have a kitchen and I no longer have any cooking ingredients. And then it said that Lord Chaitanya became a little embarrassed. And he said, okay, I'll be right back. And he went out and he came back with a large quantity of gold. It's funny, he didn't just mystically restore the house. He came back with a large quantity of gold. And she asked all the friends and neighbors for quite some time, do you know where Nimai got this gold from? You know, but she did use it to restore the house. So Krishna has different ways. You know, in this case, he restored everything in Vrindavan, so there was no flood damage. And so while all the living creatures looked on, the Supreme Personality of God had put back the hill in its original place, just as it had stood before. And the residents of Vrindavan, overwhelmed with ecstatic love, came forward to greet Krishna according to their individual relationships. The demigod sang his praises and showered flowers. It was a great festival all over the universe where the demigods played their conch shells and kettle drums and they began to sing. So Indra was feeling a little sorry. He wasn't quite sure how he should apologize. You know, if you tried to kill all the residents of Vrindavan and all the cows and destroy Vrindavan, and you tried to kill Krishna when actually you're a devotee, how exactly do you apologize for that? I mean, in my stay in the Hare Krishna movement, I must say that I have met many people who were extremely offensive. But I have not met anybody who committed this level of offense. I never met anybody who tried to, you know, physically destroy and kill a whole devotee community. So how do you apologize? So Lord Brahma suggested, he said, you better bring a devotee with you. He said, you better bring Surabhi. So he brought Surabhi to try to melt Krishna's heart. Krishna's heart also melts. By the way, it's not only that the devotee's hearts melt for Krishna, but Krishna's heart also melts for the devotees. And Krishna also enjoys having a melting heart that surpasses just logic. Logically, what should have Krishna done to Indra?
Killed him.
At least what? If he didn't kill him, he would have at least what?
Imprisoned him,
removed him from his position. Come on. But Krishna's heart also melted. Oh, here's my devotee. And he's sorry. And Indra brings Airavatam, bathes Krishna with Ganga water. And Indra was, he was very ashamed. This is the real penance. The real penance is to feel regret. And he approached him in a solitary place. It's nice that Krishna allowed Indra to apologize in private. I mean, of course, his humiliation was very public. But that wasn't Krishna's fault that Indra's humiliation was public. That was Indra's fault. But Krishna did allow Indra to apologize privately. And Indra fell down and laid his helmet, whose effulgence was as brilliant as the sun, upon the Lord's lotus feet. And again, looking at this externally, Indra is this big demigod and Krishna is this little village boy who hasn't even gone to school yet. Just takes care of cows. And Indra is falling at his feet. And Indra says, engrossed in pride over my ruling power, ignorant of your majesty, I offended you. O Lord, may you forgive me. My intelligence was bewildered, but let my consciousness never again be so impure. This is a very nice apology. He's not making any excuses. He's not making any excuses. And he's getting to the root. He said, the problem was my pride. I have caused great harm to you because I was proud. So this is... Generally, people don't apologize like this. They'll say something like, I'm sorry if you were offended. Basically, I'm really sorry that you were offended. That's basically what they're saying. You know, I remember once in a mediation where one side apologized and the other side is silent. And I look at the other side and said, do you have anything to say? And they said, you know, well... I'm sorry if you felt hurt by what we did. Basically, I really feel bad that you're so sensitive. That's actually what they're saying. So, but this is a good apology, where he's saying, it was my pride, he recognized what the problem was. And Krishna said, I wanted you to always remember me. A man blinded by intoxication with his power and opulence cannot see me nearby. Execute my order and remain in your appointed position, but be sober without false pride. That's amazing. That's really amazing. I remember when I was showing this in New Zealand for Govardhan Puja one year, and I said that I had been part of a group of devotees, and I was convinced that they had offended me. And for about 10 years, I was convinced that they had offended me. And after 10 years, I realized that I had offended them. And so I went and apologized. And afterwards, one of the devotees asked a question. He said, why would Krishna let somebody stay in the movement for 10 years if they were offensive? And I said, should Krishna have thrown me out of the Hare Krishna movement? You know, we sometimes have to, it takes us some time to understand. Indra thought, the residents of Vrindavan offended me. And it took him a week to understand, no, I'm the offender. But once we understand that, Krishna doesn't punish anymore. Once we've actually rectified our mentality, Krishna doesn't punish. He gives us time to rectify our mentality. He's patient. He's actually unlimitedly patient. And then he says, okay, now that you've rectified your mentality, go on doing what you're doing. Despite what other religions claim, God is not a big punishing type of person. If somebody's genuinely repentant, then Surabhi bathed Krishna with her milk, and Indra bathed Krishna with Ganga water. And Indra was also himself bathed with Ganga water. And Krishna received this name Govinda, as connected here with Indra, that he's the Indra of the cows. And at this point, all living creatures, even those cruel by nature, became entirely free of enmity.
All the people of Vrindavan, for your good fortune and the fortune of your cows as well, worship Govardhan Hill. All the people of Vrindavan, for your good fortune and the fortune of your cows as well. Yeah.
just realizing all these photographs are Govardhan Pujas that I've been to in those places. This is at Govardhan. The one you saw with all the food on the ground, that's in Hungary. They offer, I think, 2,000 kilos of sweets to Giriraj. It fills up as much space as this whole temple room. One year they put their Govardhan Shila in a little boat, and they put him down in the ocean of sweets. And some of the other photographs were of the hills that we would make in North Carolina at our school, and you saw my Giriraj Shila was on the hill. Okay, so here we have a very nice prayer to Govardhan that we can sing, and we'll first play again. This is Lavi singing.
Nidhi Nripari Dasa Sreni Varjati Namah Mithamida Mudita Sriradi Kavatra Chandhyam Vrachama Vatila Katte Kripta Vidaik Sputangme Vijanakatani Vasandehi Govardhan.
Okay, you think we could try singing this? Giri Nibahari Dasya Sreni Varyati Nama Mritamidam Uditam Sri Radhika Vaktra Chandrat Rajanavati Lakatve Klipta Vedas Bhutame Nija Nikatani Vasam Dehi Govardhan Twam. We can say in English. O Govardhan, O King of Mountains, O Hill whose nectar name, the best of Lord Hari's servants, flows from the moon of Sri Radha's mouth, O Hill that the Vedas declare to be the tilak marking of Raja, please grant to me residence near you. So I hope you like that presentation.